This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on the 12th of December 2015 on Monocle 24.
Leafing through the pages of 2015, it was a year that saw many publications rise and many others fall. This year saw some well-known names print their final issues, but we also saw several impressive newcomers. So what were the agenda-setting events of 2015, and what can we expect for the year ahead? The answers to those questions and many more today on The Stack. On today's show, we're looking back over the past 12 months for a long-form look at the highs and lows of 2015. Some once mighty titles disappeared from newsstand shelves as so-called lads mags struggled to remain relevant, and yet those with a better defined brand presence persevered. We'll discuss the key events over the past year and look ahead to what's happening across 2016. Plus, long considered the domain of those with buckets of cash at their disposal, is small-scale publishing finally about to flourish?
I figured if we could build a business that would enable us to make money as a real company, if only one unit per title was ever created, then we could break all the rules. So that's it. So that's what we did.
All that coming up on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tyler Brulé. We're going to jump right into the program. Our Richard Spencer Powell, our creative director, and Andrew Tuck are here just to, well, really, gentlemen, talk a little bit about our forecast. We'll come to that in a moment, but also a little bit later in the program, we're going to be joined by Alex Wish. He's a research analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence. But I think we should probably rewind to being out in front of the reindeer last week, guys. Andrew, you were probably about 5 or 6 meters away. You're manning our stand, Rich. You were inbound with your ever observant children, and it was sort of a really sort of, you know, fascinating time. But maybe, Andrew, maybe for those who didn't hear about it last week, set things up for us, and maybe how things have evolved since last year. I mean, I think we almost sort of countered our good luck 12 months ago when this came in, because it was a totally new venture for us. And you know, every time you do something new, of course, there's the excitement of the launch, but then you take a deep breath when you hear the delivery truck pull up from our printing plant down in Dorset and think, oh goodness, did we get it right?
Well, we've chosen a format we like, and we've chosen a series of papers that we like. And so in the summer, we reuse them for the escapists. But this is the second outing for the forecast. So it comes in this bookish form. It's printed on a paper which you would normally associate with paperback. So it's very light to carry around. And it has this really wonderful cover, this kind of glazed cover with a kind of really tactile diamond feel underneath the varnish. It's something very nice to hold in hand, and we wanted to kind of move the storyline on a little bit from last year, but still keep this notion that we're not just saying what's going to happen in 2016. It's a long-range view about trends in everything from architecture to current affairs.
Rich, your view. We had always a big discussion about cover. We've done something a little bit radical. We came out last year with this very hot sort of, I would almost say, sort of neon salmon cover, these spectacles, the notion of looking over the horizon. And there's elements of that, but a little bit more this year.
The thing that's satisfying most about this cover is it's a sequel, which I think is, you never really see that. You see split cover ones, but I don't think you ever see, you know, part two. And this is absolutely a part two. And for, you know, magazine fans that like to collect, when you put the two covers next to each other, it's the same illustrator. The eyewear appears again. It's a very pale grey cover, but we've used the same fluoro orange in the hit. So they work, you know, in unison. And I think that's one, I'm particularly proud that we went with that. And two, we were speaking earlier today, Tyler, about the difference between, you know, commercial work and editorial work, and the balance on the two floors in this building. And, you know, you talk about being in, and you know, in editorial, we are our own masters. And that's what is so satisfying about it, because you can fire off an email to your bosses and say, shall we put a man and a monkey in a spa on the cover? And they get straight back to you and say, yeah, I love it. And then we do it. I mean, that is what is nice about, you know, just taking the gloves off and just going for it. And that's, I think, what's the great, you know, asset of editorial work, but also something about forecast, the time of the year we do it. I think we kind of let our hair right down on this one.
And the illustrator that we're talking about is Nuratake. And yeah, if you spend any time in great bookstores, you know, places which are doing, well, good print, good T-shirts, here's someone who is in all of the right select shops all over Japan. But it's interesting also how we've chosen him, that we just keep him sort of preserved only for this. This forecast is his thing, and you don't see him anywhere else across the year.
Absolutely. He's like Christmas dinner. It's once a year he comes out, and, you know, he's brilliant.
In a moment, we're going to be joined by Alex Wish from Bloomberg Intelligence. That's right after this. You're listening to The Stack. Andrew, very good to see you. See you upstairs in a moment. Rich?
Thank you.
See you around, maybe on the dance floor later in the week.
Maybe. Who knows?
You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. Stay with us. Time to welcome Alex Wish. He's a research analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence, based out of here in London, but looking really across a variety of companies and mostly within the European theatre. Just before we went on air, you know, you've given us a number of talking points today, so there's probably a lot of things for us to rattle through quite quickly. And we'll come maybe towards the end, Alex, to talk a little bit about 2016. And I know it's always hard to sort of gaze it into a crystal ball and look across 12 months, but we'll try to do that. But I wanted to just start on book publishing. We came back from the Frankfurt Book Fair feeling, of course, as a business which we, you know, we put out a lot of books ourselves and we make a magazine, there seemed to be a lot of excitement when I spoke to the CEO there that they are a book fair, and yes, you know, it's a great market for trading intellectual property, etc. But the fair came off, you know, not far off the back of news that the New York Times did this story about the fact that we've seen, you know, ebook sales going soft, tablet sales going soft, that maybe we are in a moment of change, or at least where things seem to be bedded down slightly, that, okay, you know, let's not try to just push everyone out of paper. If people want to read on paper, great. And if people want to read digitally, they can read on digital. But let's not try to have it one way or the other. Is that something that you think has been a bit of a defining story for us this year?
I think the more than actually the cultural change and whether people are, you know, reading digitally or in print, the big story for me has been the fact that the distribution platforms where you can buy the books is dominated by Amazon and Apple. So it's a case of the publishers actually not being very happy with their ability to price the products the way they want to price them. So at the end of the day, I think that people will go to where the content is. If the content is online, they will go online. If the content is in print, they will go to print at the right price in the right place. And I think that what is happening today is that there's no choice for the publisher. There was a big battle with Amazon, a dispute over 2014, and basically most of the publishers did settle and they found an agreement, but that is still not filtering through to sales. So I don't think the publishers are very happy with just having basically two distribution platforms.
And talking about, you know, whether it's you know, analog or otherwise, but, you know, if we look at, you know, the traditional outside back covers of magazines, if we look at, you know, the opening spreads, etc., you know, some magazines seem to be flourishing, and then, you know, some magazines which, you know, very much relied on fragrance advertising, you know, maybe, you know, mid market fashion brands, etc. And I'm thinking about, you know, the lads market in the UK, and also the men's magazine, that middle part of the men's magazine sort of fashion style market, you know, is being challenged in a lot of markets. And of course, it's challenged partly by readership, but also by advertising as well. And what's been the sort of the general state of print advertising across 2015?
The general trend has been a decline. And it's not just 2015. It's basically for 3-4 years, we've seen a structural decline in readership and advertising dollars. That said, I sense that there's something starting to change here. And the main reason for that is basically there's a big debate on the time that we spend and how much money advertisers spend on those publications. So to give you a reference, in newspapers and magazines, we spend typically 4% of our media time on that media. But advertising expenditure on that media globally is about 18%. If you read that, you would say, well, why are we spending so much money in newspapers and magazines and we're spending so little time? So the debate and the big questions that we're starting to ask now is how engaged you are when you're actually reading a print magazine or newspaper. Let's put it in context. When you're on an airplane and you're reading the airport magazine, you have no access to Wi-Fi, for the most part, and you're trapped in a plane and you're thinking about your travel, business or pleasure, and you're very focused on the magazine because you have nothing else to do. So that the value of the engagement that you have with the article you're reading and the advertising that you can see is arguably much higher than when you're scrolling through a feed on Facebook.
Right. And do you think that penny is starting to drop with media agencies? They're starting to realize that. So that might be a little bit of a rethink we start to see across 2016, 2017.
I think now the agencies and the media owners are still very confused because there's a big trend started with the digital growth is basically the ability to measure. So advertisers and advertising companies are pushing things that they can measure. So how do you measure? So it's easy to measure clicks, purchases after the click, but it's hard to measure the engagement.
I think that sort of level of passion. I mean, one thing we always talk about here is also if these channels are free, what is my level of engagement if I've on any number of social media platforms? They don't cost me anything to engage. I mean, I've got my mobile device, they're there, versus if I buy a copy of Bloomberg Businessweek or if I've gone and spent, you know, 6-7 euros buying Die Zeit at a random airport. Is that part of what's there as well? That idea that I'm engaged also because I've actually had to part with cash to purchase that media brand.
That's right. So you have a stake in it in a way. And also there's on the other side. So one thing is that the emphasis on the print itself, the value of the engagement. And at the same time, we're seeing a backlash in the basically overvaluation of some digital engagement. Let me give you an example. So Facebook, when you're looking at the feed and you have video impressions, it's a high growth area for them. So that video impression is charged to the advertiser even if you look at it without volume. So how engaged are you? You spent 1 second, 2 seconds hovering a video that didn't have any volume and you watched a brand allegedly there.
And you may not even see the logo.
That's right. That's it. And you're being charged for that.
Right.
So I think there's going to be a backlash in terms of like the booming growth that we've seen in some areas of digital media where the engagement is actually quite low.
Mm. Over the last 2 weeks, we've seen a flurry of mergers, you know, big M&A in the world of hotels, for example. I mean, just, you know, the end of this week, we saw, of course, the big Accor Fairmont deal. But also in the world of media, and particularly in print, I think everyone was really a flutter this summer, early autumn, with the Nikkei coming in, swooping in almost out of nowhere to pick up the FT. Is that the final chapter? I mean, obviously the year is out. We're probably not going to see anything else happen there. But do we see any other type of big consolidation in the world of newspapers, do you think, as we look ahead?
Well, I think that the trophy assets, and that's what I would consider the FT, that's what I would consider the Wall Street Journal, and hopefully your magazine as well. I think that there are some trophy assets out there, and they carry a very premium valuation. New York Times is a trophy asset. And I think those, more than just being a circulation or an advertising driver, I think those are brands that can engage and reach to audiences. And the power of those brands has to be recognized in the valuation. I think that's another big driver of valuations in the M&A that we're likely to see over the next year.
Just before we go, one last point that you brought up was just this notion of sort of going beyond advertising and beyond print. And you cite a couple of professional publishers in the mix. What are you seeing there? Because it's often an overlooked part of the sector as well.
Yes, we have what we call the professional publishers, companies that basically sell to legal professionals, to business professionals. And what we see in that space is that these companies that used to own journals or catalogs and databases, they're increasingly software companies. They're still a publisher, but the way they engage with the audience, they offer workflow solutions. And that's another exciting area of, you know, traditional publishing. You follow the audiences where the audiences are. If the digital marketplace allows you to offer more functionality, then why not offer that functionality? And these companies are capturing that.
Okay, now I'm going to put you on the spot just before we go. 2016, is it a year of maybe sort of, you know, flattening out, maybe a little less hysteria around crazy digital valuations? Do we see maybe a little bit more interest? I mean, you know, we talked about the FT a second ago and maybe these trophy brands. You know, how does it look for you? Particularly at a time also when amidst everything else that you would look at as an analyst as well, knowing that, you know, the market might be challenged because of obviously political instability. How does that impact advertising, etc.? So big question, Alex.
Yeah, so 2016, I'm very positive on 2016 because of the big events that we have next year with the sporting events. These are big drivers of advertising, US presidential elections as well. So we have a lot more spending out there. At the same time, growth in mobile is ballooning. So basically, we have the market in mobile advertising that's really skyrocketing now, doubling, probably 40% up next year globally. And basically, that's another big driver. Now, how brands react to that, that is what we have to look at. It's a finer print. When we're talking about mobile advertising, are we just talking about Facebook? Are we, you know, what are we talking about? How is your online presence out there in the mobile space? Are you monetizing it? And how are you monetizing? Is it subscription? Is it advertising? So the growth is there. There are areas that are looking very, very interesting. In digital as well, and digital on desktop as well. But will it be search? Will it be banner advertising? Or a combination of both? Or classifieds, which is another growth area when you're talking about newspapers. Newspapers are actually owning a lot of classifieds brands online. So we see areas that are growing strongly. We see a continued decline in print, in the advertising space, but also the debate in print, I think, is likely to be richer as to the engagement and the power that that 4% time that we spent on those publications can derive more engagement and value for the advertiser.
We'll be leading the charge on that one. Alex Wish also will probably be checking in with you sometime around the end of Q1 to see how this shapes up. Alex Wish, research analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. After the break, is small-scale publishing finally about to thrive? I'll speak to one person who's so sure she's betting her business on it. That's on The Stack right after this. Now, for a long time, the world of publishing was restricted to those willing and happy to print hundreds, if not thousands, of copies up front. Niche titles were rather more difficult to produce as they stared down the risk of facing a slow start. Blurb is one company setting out to change that. Its model of on-demand printing is helping to open the industry to those with smaller scale ideas, while also offering a business model that's more in line with modern publishing economics. Eileen Gittins is the CEO of Blurb, and she's joins me now in studio. Eileen, I guess I wanted to start because we're in a bit of a curious era right now. If I think about people who are in, I don't know, Australia, New Zealand, West Coast, who are listening to this right now, we have a lot of listeners, of course, who are really, of course, very passionate about print. But I think, you know, and they might know how to set up a grid. They certainly know what good photography looks like, how to commission those photographers. And they probably also, you know the illustrators they want to commission as well. And then, of course, the writers, the poets, and whoever else they want to collaborate with. But there's also this whole business side. And I think a lot of people wrestle with that. And certainly when we have events, Eileen, people often say to me, well, you know, how do you really actually make it happen? You know, and of course, we've seen, you know, so many magazines launching. But, you know, when you look at the context of Blurb, how does it actually work?
What happens is that people can come to blurb.com or blurb.co.uk, since we're in London right now, and they can choose a tool for creating a book. Now, that can be Adobe InDesign, because we're partnered with Adobe. Mm-hmm. We have a plugin. It's free. Download it. It just sets up the file structure for you. It's awesome. Or you can use one of our free tools. Since so many of your folks are designers, I'm presuming they'll use InDesign. Mm. Once you've got your file created and uploaded, then the magic of Blurb really goes into effect. Because at that point, we've now created and perfected a way to, from the same file, output to both ebook and e-magazine, as well as print. So then the question becomes, okay, how many do you want to buy? If the answer is, no, I want them available printed on demand, they will be printed on demand. And we have 7 print locations around the world, plus 3 additional offset locations. So again, from the same file, you can print them on demand or have them printed one at a time, as if it is the only unit of that title ever to exist. Or you can, in fact, order hundreds or even thousands via offset. Once that happens, and your question about funding, let me make a comment about that. So we started to see a lot of books come in through Kickstarter. And here's how it happens. You do a Kickstarter or a crowdfunding somewhere. In the case of Kickstarter, we now have an automated process where we can take the CSV file, in other words, the file of all of your supporters with their addresses and names. Once your book or magazine is completed, then we deal with the printing and the fulfillment directly. Because what we learned is that You know, some guy who lives in Brooklyn, a third floor walk-up, what is he going to do with 1,000 books?
Right.
So we deal with the whole business side of the back end. And if you put a markup on your book, we send you money at the end of every month.
Which is great.
It's a miracle.
Now tell me, so let's say print on demand. I've developed a quarterly magazine that I want to get out. It's all designed up. I've sort of figured out how to commission and sort of fund that bit. So then I'm the reader. I've heard about Eileen's quarterly and I want to go and purchase. It's done print on demand. So is it by page? I mean, how does that bit work? So if it's 100 pages, is that my starting point? Am I able to identify paper stock, all of those types of things?
Yes. We launched in 2006. So over the years, we've become much more facile at being able to add trim sizes in different papers. So for those of your listeners who are maybe familiar with Mohawk, we use Mohawk Superfine paper. We offer that, which is an uncoated paper stock. We also have several premium papers and ProLine papers, as well as standard papers in the text world. What we're now seeing designers do is actually kind of move away from the glossy and moving into the more organic and toothy.
Yeah.
And they're also less expensive to produce.
Now, it's when you talk about, you know, the part of the business, of course, has been e-books and e-magazines, etc. This side, now you moved into print magazines. Is this a little bit of a testimony for the fact that, you know, it's probably good to be present on paper, no matter how much you like being on a backlit screen, it's good to exist on a coffee table?
You're preaching to the choir.
The show is hosted by the choir, this program.
There, we should start singing. So, yeah, I started the company because I'm a photographer. And I wanted to produce 40 books for 40 people who were the subjects of the project I was doing. And I discovered that that was very difficult to do in 2005. You could produce 1,000, and then I could find 960 new friends to give them away to and spend a lot of money. But it was not possible to do 40. And I tell you this because I'm such a believer in the power of physicality in print that I ended up honestly building a company to solve this problem.
Mm.
The business model issue was at the time, and I knew nothing about publishing, Tyler. I mean, I was completely clueless. I realized pretty quickly that publishers are like VCs for authors. They take all the risk up front. It's portfolio theory, and they hope like hell at least hit it out of the park because the rest won't. Well, I figured if we could build a business that would enable us to make money as a real company, if only one unit per title was ever created, then we could break all the rules. So that's it. So that's what we did. I mean, it sounds simple now, but that was basically the precept. And the whole backbone of the business was in print because I knew I could do a website for those 40 people. It wouldn't be the same experience and it would not be a gift. And actually, that was my intention. I wanted to physically give people something and say thank you.
Well, I think for all of those listeners who think they have a quarterly title, a zine, a novel in them, there's no excuse over the coming holidays, is there?
No.
Just got to get on with it.
Just get on with it. By the way, if I can make one final comment, one thing I hear all the time from creatives is they're not ready. The work has to be perfect. Stop. For less than the cost of a pizza, make a maquette. Hmm. Make a proof. Do something. Get it back. Learn. Rinse. Repeat. Do it again. That's it.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We're counting down. It's what, probably another, well, depends on where you are in the world, 10 to 14 days left of Christmas shopping. If you happen to be passing through London, I'm very happy to say that Jeremy Leslie of Mag Culture, and of course, he's a voice very, very familiar to many who listen to this program, has finally opened up his new little shop in London's Clerkenwell. And if magazines sort of seem like the right stocking stuffers, or you, of course, you know, maybe want to buy whole bundles for people to put under the tree, I'm also happy to say that our Fernando Augusto Pacheco is on the other side of London, having a look and leafing through titles at this very moment. Fernando, tell us a little bit about what you're seeing.
Thanks, Tyler. And of course, now I'm here with Jeremy Leslie. And Jeremy, before we describe the space, it's your first trading day today.
Yes.
How does it feel? How's it going? I have to say, I had a glass of Prosecco just now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've got a bit of bubbly on the go to welcome people. We had the big launch party early in the week, and that went very well. And today's our first actual open day. It's just been the lunch hour around here. There's a lot of studios and offices, and so it's been very busy.
How does it feel? I mean, you've been writing about magazines for such a long time, and now you have your own space.
Well, it's been a long-term kind of, I wouldn't say ambition, but this vague dream I had to do something like this, and I can't quite believe it at the moment, but it's been fantastic just watching people there just doing what I want them to do, and that is come in and feel comfortable and welcome, standing at our big magazine shelf and browsing, flicking, enjoying the experience, and then making some decisions, and each person buying two or three copies of things. It's great. It's a real buzz.
Can you describe the space for us? It looks very airy, you know, it looks very pleasant, you know, but tell us a bit more.
The shop unit itself is a very special piece of design. We've kind of restored it more to its original form. When we first saw the space, it had been modernized in that way where there's a full ceiling and there are plastic tiles on the floor, but once we looked above the ceiling we realized there's a fantastic sloping ceiling with some skylights in it, so we've opened all that up, so it's got a big tall ceiling, big open space, it's all white. But one of the best features was when we stripped off the old flooring to find the original terrazzo flooring underneath, so we've got this beautiful hard surface, black and white with a red grid on it, which is very kind of structured and designed and magazine-like, but also the red relates to the Mag Culture branding and everything. And it's just at that point we knew we were in the right place. We've had a lot of bespoke work done with a great pair of carpenters, South London makers, and then on top of all their work, we've got a large installation of the 606 shelving system from Bitsu.
Shall we talk a little bit about some of the titles? I mean, I can recognize some of them from your website as well, of course. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, what do you, for example, if I'm a young kind of person, I had my first issue, do you think, would you like to sell perhaps my magazine as well? Are you open for this kind of new magazines coming out?
Always open. I mean the stock is very much based on what you will read on the Mag Culture Journal and might have been reading over the last few years. It's a familiar set of magazines in one sense, but there'll be a lot of surprises as well. London's quite well served with magazines shops that will do you various things, and it's quite hard to find somewhere which does a really good broad selection of some of the better mainstream magazines, some of the most well-known independent magazines, your Gentlewoman and the Gorman, you know, the ones we always often talk about on the show. But then also we've got some more of the obscure ones, some nice examples, new magazines from abroad. I'm very keen to bring in new magazines as well, so I'm open to anyone that's making a magazine to get in touch. But it's very exciting. There's a really, I think, a strong range.
Well, thank you very much, Jeremy. And back to Tyler.
Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. They're on the other side of London, not too far away, at Mag Culture's new shop here in London's Clerkenwell. And sounds like we can highly recommend it if you want to look for a few interesting presents before the end of the year. I'm sure also if you want to give Jeremy Leslie a gift, I would imagine he's probably also open to franchise offers. Anyway, that's all the time we have for this week's show. My thanks to our producer, Ben Rylan. Of course, this program usually researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and, as ever, Claire Urban. Manning the decks, and she's going to be manning the dance floor, I have a feeling, in a couple of days when we have our big Christmas do here in London. If you have any comments or queries, then do drop us a note to info@monocle.com, and remember, we're back at the same time next Saturday, and of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes. You've been listening to The Stack with me, Tyler Brulé. Have a great weekend. Goodbye.